So this is, tonight is the second to the last Wednesday evening that we'll have for Dharma Talks here at the Santa Cruz Zen Center. And then we'll be closed for a period up until New Year's, from the 24th to the 31st. Oh, Scott. Hi, Scott. And on New Year's Eve, we will have this very kind of traditional ceremonial sitting that Buddhists do all over the world, which is to sit and welcome the new year. And so the first thing I want to do is invite everybody to that. It's a very beautiful time that sort of accords with what we often do, practitioners or not, at the end of a year, which is we begin to sort of think about what has happened and what comes next. We maybe evaluate our lives, our commitments, and maybe we make New Year's resolutions. We kind of go through our regrets. We hope that our karma will be sufficiently burned up from the last year so that we may start the new year afresh. And so we do all of that together on New Year's Eve. So if you'd like to come and join us, please do. So I think what I'd like to do tonight is to talk a little bit about a very big subject, which is really Zen practice, sesshin, and everyday life. And obviously this is way too big a topic to really make any significant dent into it, but I want to just pick up a little corner of it and talk a little bit about the practice of Zazen. And this talk tonight sort of comes from actually some of the talks that Kokyo gave during sesshin, and maybe a little bit from the Shosan ceremony that took place last week. And we had this incredible ceremony here last week instead of a Dharma talk. It was really a ceremony that was a meeting of teacher and student, which we sometimes do privately with a Zen teacher, kind of a one-on-one, face-to-face meeting. And last week we did something that I don't know that we've actually done that here in this Zendo, but we had kind of like a public Dokusan type thing. And it was a very beautiful ceremony. It sort of capped or ended, marked the end of a seven-day sit, which is a pretty long sit. And it also marked December 8th, Rohatsu, or Buddha's, the awakening of the historical Buddha, Buddha's enlightenment. And, you know, last week when I came to the Shosan ceremony, I have been to some of these before, and the mere fact that we were having it was so beautiful to me that in a way, my intellectual mind just dropped away. All my ideas about what the ceremony is, what one should do during it, and how one should act, and what kinds of questions does one ask a Zen teacher, a Zen master, all of that just kind of fell completely by the wayside. And when all of that kind of intellectual idea of what I should do fell away, some of kind of what is up in my life right now, which is a lot of grief and loss, just kind of bubbled up to the surface. So I'm sitting on this mat in front of Kokyo and I'm crying. And I, you know, that kind of crying where the snot is coming down your nose and you're thinking, darn, I'm supposed to like maybe act a little differently. And mostly, darn, because my Kleenex is way in here, and by the time I get it out, the snot will be down here, and I can't really wipe it exactly on the okesa, so what should I do? And so you sit there and go, and you know, you try to kind of get it back up there. But I wanted to say that part of the beauty of this ceremony is that we come forth with our kind of deepest and most intimate kinds of questions or issues. And I think for many of us, this kind of dropping away of the conceptual mind is a really important part of kind of being present, being authentic, being whatever it is that you are and feeling emotionally right at that moment. And it seems to me that that's kind of one of the things that we do in Zen practice, and that's one of the things that we cultivate. So, and you know, at the same time, as I sit before you tonight, the same issues of grief and loss are very much up in my life, and yet, you know, kind of my intellectual mind is ready to do a little bit of work tonight and engage all of us, I hope, in some kind of discussion. So I want to sort of open this talk by giving you an excerpt from a Shosan ceremony that occurred in 1967 at Tassajara with Suzuki Roshi. And because of the miracle of the internet and tape recordings and people who are willing to translate, some of this stuff is available to us. For those of you maybe who don't know, Suzuki Roshi is the founder of this lineage of Zen practice in the West, in the United States. And so he, at Tassajara Monastery, which is kind of like a training monastery for Buddhist monks and priests, initiated Shosan ceremonies, I think, as soon as Tassajara opened. And so this is a Shosan ceremony, a one-to-one public meeting with students that took place. And one of the students says, comes and he asks this question. He said, "What is the difference between sesshin," which is one of these longer sits, "what is the difference between sesshin and everyday life?" And then the same person says, "This is a useless question." And Suzuki Roshi says, "Of course, everyday life is sesshin, and sesshin is everyday life. Although the way is different, but that it is a little different means that it's an expression of our practice. Again, form is emptiness, and emptiness is form." And then the student says, "Thank you very much," and bows and goes back to his seat. And let me just offer you another excerpt, which is from someone who many of us know either by reputation or maybe we know him personally, Ed Brown. And so Ed goes up before Suzuki Roshi and he says, I don't understand what I've done." And there's a little bit of a, kind of a translation problem here, so some of this is dropped off. But Suzuki Roshi starts to answer him by saying, "Because you want to understand when you are doing something, why is it really necessary for you to understand? Buddha knows. At least I know. And people know, when you bow to the Zendo, when everything is ready," Ed was the cook at Tassajara, "when you bow to the Zendo, when everything is ready, everyone knows. So find out what you are doing moment after moment. For instance, when you bow to me, when you bow to the Zendo, when you hear the bubbling sound of the rice, there you will find out yourself. That is, call your name and address yourself." And so I want to kind of talk a little bit about each of these things. And let me first start by raising this question of, you know, when we say something like everyday life is sesshin and sesshin is everyday life, it's easy to hear those words and to go, uh-huh, I agree. It's a little bit like saying zazen is everyday life and everyday life is sitting, or everyday life is zazen. And yet, I think the kind of deeper meaning below that is harder to grab onto. So I want to say, how is it exactly that everyday life is like sesshin? on the face of it, superficially, it seems to me we could go right away to actually everyday life is nothing like Sesshin. In everyday life, there are kids, there are family, in-laws, colleagues, crazy drivers on the road. There are telephones and traffic and computers. And in Sesshin, there's that wall that sits in front of you. That is, when we're sitting, Zazen, there's that wall with little pockmarks in it, maybe, or if you're fortunate, there's like little things that you can see, you can imagine that are in the wall. But basically, there is just that wall. In everyday life, there are innumerable decisions. Should I buy this? Should I buy that? Should I cook this? Should I cook that? There are errands, projects, there are plans to be made, and so on. But in Sesshin, there is just that wall again. There are not really decisions to be made. There's a schedule, and you follow the schedule. It's a little bit like you sit at 5:45 and it ends at 6:25. There's not a lot to it, not a lot of decision making. You don't have a lot of kind of volition that you have to exercise during that period. Easy, right?
Right.
And yet, the same monkey mind or restless mind that is looking at that wall and maybe saying, oh, I see a giraffe, or, oh, no, that actually looks like a cloud. Or, you know, you make little animals, or you tell little stories, or you have fantasies, or you're kind of working on something because you're just sitting there and there's lots of time to do that. That same mind is the same mind that we use to make those decisions in everyday life, to cook for our families, to care for our friends, to go to work, to make projects, to do plans, and to dig holes, literally and figuratively. Okay. So, you know, in Sesshin, that little monkey mind finds that place where we're thinking, wow, I wish we had pumpkin today instead of almonds. Or I wish we had yesterday's salad. Or I wish I could eat this. Or in my case, wow, I really feel like having a bowl of Cheerios. Wouldn't it be nice if I could just go someplace and have a bowl of Cheerios? I think other things, but for some reason, Cheerios always come to the fore for me. There's something about cereal or toast that really kind of is my Sesshin thing, you know? Oh, that and butt pain. Butt pain. Back pain, butt pain, neck pain, the whole thing, the whole nine yards. So perhaps maybe one of the ways that we talk about Sesshin and Zazen is that maybe many of us think about it as a kind of training for everyday life. We practice just sitting so that we can carry that mind, that equanimity, that calmness, that that ability to sit and to quiet, to be quiescent into the realm of everyday life. And I think that's true, at least theoretically. It works to a certain extent. You'll let me know if I say anything blasphemous, right? So for example, you might, maybe if you've been sitting for a while, you might, when you go home and you're about to yell at your neighbor under your breath, or maybe right out loud, or maybe you're going to cuss out the car that just cut in front of you, or whatever it is that brings up the heat and the anger or the frustration, maybe Zazen pays off because we're less likely to do that. Or we might actually be able to haul ourselves back from that habitual activity of being critical or judging or getting hot under the collar. So in effect, you know, we vow to take that practice from the cushion out onto the street. And whether it is your family woes or family celebrations, you know, maybe that works. most of the time. Or maybe that works some of the time, or maybe it doesn't work at all. And then maybe when it doesn't work, we say, oh, I blew it. I'm going to go back and sit some more, because obviously I need a little bit more improvement than I thought. And so maybe if I sit more, I accumulate more sitting time, it will help me even more out in my life outside of the Zen Center or off the cushion. And one of the most interesting things I think happened in Sesshin this last week, and that was that Kokyo gave a series of talks. Really, they were about kind of different kinds of meditation, but for the first time, I heard a lot of conversation about meditation practices. And I found that actually fascinating, because mostly we experience this by ourselves. You know, you sit and you look at the wall, and maybe you make little animals, or you run your stories, or you run your evaluations, or you run your hopes for the future. But this was sort of different. This was kind of like, you know, some people have light shows. Some people kind of drift off into this sleepy kind of alpha brainwaves type state that we think is, you know, kind of a kind of awakeness that maybe is awakeness and maybe not. But we began to kind of be very explicit about what happens when you're sitting. Some people, you know, it's like you could count your breaths and then a little critter goes running across your radar. It turns out one of our most venerable members sees rabbits occasionally. And so, you know, just to actually have this talk about Zazen and what happens during Zazen, I thought was enormously helpful, because it made, in a way, the practice of it much more explicit. And it allowed, at least for myself, an opportunity to think more deeply about what is it that we're doing when we're sitting on this cushion. So Kokyo lectured every day, and if you want to hear these lectures, you can, of course. You too can download them onto your iPod, iPhone, computer, and listen to them, because they are on the Santa Cruz Zen Center website. And what I found is I was only there for part of the Sesshin, but they were so interesting, I had to go back and listen to the rest of them at the end of Sesshin. And I have to say, I thought you did a great job, because he kept saying that there would be this stuff about vipassana and insight, but he never quite got to it during the days that I was there. So it was a little bit like seeing the trailer for a movie, but not seeing the end of the movie. So I needed to listen to the end. So one of the things that he talked about was were two kinds of meditation, shamita and vipassana. And shamita is often described as a kind of single-pointed meditation that's necessary in order to have insight or to gain insight. Vipassana, into the emptiness of reality. And as I understand these two kinds of meditation, they are practiced essentially in sequence, so that this thing where I'm thinking about the Cheerios or making animals out of the little marks in the wall here, that is actually not really shamita, which was very discouraging to me, because I thought that all time spent on the cushion was completely exquisite, valuable time, regardless of what I was doing. But this is really a kind of a very detailed description of what we do to gain insight into the emptiness of reality. So shamita, which I guess is it translated as calm abiding?
Shamatha.
Thank you. Is necessary to kind of go to the next level. And it's like when you play a game, you know, you're at level one and you go to level two. You need level one in order to go to level two. And um, Our mind, of course, is very present in both shamatha and vipassana. And in a way, I think about these practices or these kinds of meditation as a way, as a way also to deal with our minds or to think about our minds, to kind of embody what's going on with our minds. And during his talks, Kokyo raised a distinction between what he called mind and the nature of mind. And mind, according to or following this discussion, has to do with the conceptual mind, the intellectual mind that's able to make the distinctions, make judgments, make evaluations. It is both the mind, for example, that understands that we are in calm abiding, that I am no longer making little animals out of the shapes and the plaster and the wall, but I am following my breath. I'm counting my breaths. I'm following my breaths. I'm stopping my breath, and so on. The nature of mind, on the other hand, is a different quality of mind. And I think Rob did this in Chosan, where he went like this, and then like this. Or was it like this, and then like this? But at one point, Kokyo said the distinction between mind and nature of mind is like the front of the hand and the back of the hand. They're related, but they are in fact quite different. And the nature of mind then is a mind that doesn't, what would you say? It doesn't actually see anything. So whereas the mind sees or understands that one is sitting in zazen and calm abiding, the nature of mind has a different experience of that. And I'm not sure exactly how to explain this, so I have a very kind of basic way to understand this, which is first that to understand emptiness, we have often a kind of intellectual understanding that everything is empty. At the same time that there also exists form. And in that intellectual understanding of it, we sort of reach partway in to kind of ultimate as opposed to conventional reality. So for example, when we habitually become angry or tense or anxious or maybe laugh out of nervousness, if we are restraining ourselves or pulling ourselves back from those habitual actions, in some ways our mind is able to see that, to evaluate that, to say, yes, I'm pulling back, or I'm watching myself be angry but not actually express that anger. I'm watching myself be anxious but I'm not expressing that anxiety. And on the other hand, the nature of mind doesn't see that. It doesn't see anything. It doesn't actually experience oneself as pulling back. And I think Kokyo said something like the nature of mind is in all of us. We all have that, and yet it is not really ours. So it's not Dana's, or it's not Rain's. It's not, doesn't belong to Kokyo. It's actually that, the nature of mind would be something that is shared amongst all of us, that we co-produce, in effect. Let me see if I can get at this in a somewhat different way. I think the nature of mind is precisely that kind of boundarylessness that Suzuki Roshi was invoking in relation to Ed Brown's question. So when Ed said, I don't understand what I've done, and Suzuki Roshi is responding, well, I understand, and the other people understand, he's in effect sort of saying to Ed, when we understand And you will find yourself right in that moment from our understanding. It's a kind of, well, I don't know exactly how to describe it, except to say that it's co-produced. So let me try to get at this one other way. And that is that this being the end of the year, there are all these kind of transitions that are taking place. This is a time of year when we do the Rohatsu Sesshin. This is a time of year when, as we look forward to the new year, and we begin to think about the past and what's coming in the future, this is a time of year when the light will begin to change. The light is always changing, of course, but we're approaching the darkest night of the year. And if you're into that sort of solstice type thing, and things are constantly changing. And, you know, for Japanese people, and for me as a Japanese American, New Year's is probably the most important time of year. This is a time of year when, I know in Japan, I think many, many, many people, maybe not all, but many, many, a great majority of Japanese, they do something at a temple. And they're not sitting zazen, they might be just like going to do an offering, ringing the bell and throwing some money in the box. But if there is a time when people go to a Buddhist temple, this would be the time of year that they do so. And it's very symbolic as a time in which people are thinking ahead and letting go of the past. And part of that ritual letting go of the past has to do with kind of going to the temple, hearing the 108 bells, maybe doing an offering. One of the more kind of ritualistic things that that people do is they clean the house inside and out. I can call this obsessive because I am myself Japanese American, but this is a time when people clean, like they wash the cupboards, they wash the floors, everything is clean in preparation for the new year. And in fact, even the kinds of foods that people eat, it's very much kind of associated with a new year celebration. And kind of embedded in this is somewhere deep down, even if people don't actively practice Buddhism in their lives, is kind of the issue of going to temple. So after you clean your house, you go to the temple, and then you eat this kind of series of foods on the new year. So I've been thinking about a lot of this transition this year. And this week, as I've been out walking my dog at night, I don't know if you know that this is the week of what are called the Geminids. You know the Geminids? The Geminids are a meteor shower. And they're very beautiful. And they come usually kind of in the middle of December. And I happened to be out walking my dog, Morgan, when I think maybe on the 12th, I saw this streak just go across the sky. And I always feel very fortunate when I see these things because I feel like, oh, how lucky am I that I got to see that. I wasn't looking for it, right? It just, like, the whole sky went like a little blaze. And why I feel lucky, I don't know. I don't think it's actually quite right for me to feel lucky. Like, why that makes me feel special is sort of peculiar, I think. But there is something about the vastness of the sky, the incredible kind of magic of seeing something streak across the sky. There's something that kind of harkens, at least for myself, this sense of kind of the hugeness of the universe and my very small, modest place in it. And there's a kind of witnessing of some of the activity in the universe that I have nothing to do with but got a chance to see. And it's interesting. I always feel this urge to like report it, like put it on my Facebook page or something. Saw a meteor. But I'm not really sure what that does, except it's sort of, it's really got this big emphasis on a meteor. But it's a very kind of awesome thing. So I went online to find out a little bit more about the Geminids. And the Geminids, as it turns out, are a kind of poor stepsister to the Perseids, which are the August meteor showers. So the Perseids are probably a little over 2,000 years old. So maybe even some of Dogen's students actually saw the Perseids, right? They're old, they come from a comet. Most of the meteors that you see going across the sky are from comets. If you really want to have a killjoy experience, you should go directly to the NASA site to read about meteor showers. So it turns out the Geminids are actually, I think the NASA scientists described them as debris. Debris, not from a comet, but from a dead asteroid. And I was thinking all of that magic about the universe and the vastness of space and my sort of recognizing my little place in the universe, all from watching some debris go across the sky. Now, if you go out and you look for meteors, which sometimes people do, particularly in August, you know, it's like you go out, you have to make all these decisions. Should I look at this horizon or this horizon? Should I use a telescope? Should I use binoculars? What if I don't see one? You know, it has this kind of intentional, deliberate set of activities. It's a whole different thing when it just kind of comes across the sky. And that distinction, I think, between the looking and the deliberateness and the having it just happen out of the corner of your eye, no matter what you make of it, is like the difference between this and this. So let me say something or give you a little bit of Dogen, who I think is much more gracious about this. This is a excerpt from the Dharma Hall Discourses. And this particular Dharma Hall Discourse is called Scooping Up the Dharmakaya. And it goes like this. I can remember a monk asked Yunmen, what is the phrase that pervades the Dharma body? And Yunmen said, hide the body within the Big Dipper. And Dogen said, Yunmen gave a very good answer, but he was only able to say 80 or 90%. I love these 80 or 90% things. Suppose someone asked Ehe, what is the phrase that pervades the Dharma body? I would say to him, the dipper scoops up Shakyamuni, a measuring cup, assesses Bodhidharma. So I think what he's saying here, the dipper scoops up Shakyamuni, a measuring cup, assesses Bodhidharma. That's the remaining 20% or 10%, which is a little bit like the difference between going out and looking for meteor showers and deciding to look here or there versus having, in effect, the universe turn you. I'm actually literally looking for dog poop because that's what I'm doing when I'm walking my dog at night and this thing streaks across the sky. And so there is no intentionality. There is no I, really, that's part of seeing something like the Geminids streak across. So let me read you just one more thing and then we can maybe have some discussion. Since we're in the at the end of the year, this is this particular excerpt is called The One Self at Year's End. And this is how it goes. The sun is setting on this year and we meet the spring. In Japan, you know, the spring follows right after the end of December. The causes and conditions of birth and death, how they disturb people, take up the 1,000 differences and 10,000 distinctions and make them one, letting go of subject and object. Although this is so, do not recognize a self as a pure Dharmakaya. And, there's probably many different layers at which to understand this, but when I read this, I think the understanding that I want to stress is that when we focus on the self as the person who does the zazen, who sits in calm abiding, who looks for meteor showers, who wonders what we have done, in effect, we're only at the 80 or 90%. Or actually, I think in your talk you were saying 40 or 50 or 60%. It's the remaining 10, 15, 20% where the universe turns us. That is part of that kind of gets at, really, the nature of mind. Thank you. I didn't mean to, but I think I scared away those people.
Did you want to take some questions, Dana?
No. Sure. The bubbling of the rice? Let's see, what exactly did he say? He says, at least I know and people know. When you bow to the Zendo, when everything is ready, everyone knows. So find out what you are doing moment after moment. For instance, when you bow to me, when you bow to the Zendo, when you hear the bubbling sound of the rice. There you will find out yourself. I read that and understand that as at the moment when we ask, what have I done? You're already talking about something that's already done. And the moment that you want to kind of make that understanding of what I have done work is when you're actually doing that thing, when you're serving, when you're bowing. So the ritual itself, right when you're bowing to the Zendo or preparing the food, that's the moment, is right in that moment.
I see, and you were sort of making the connection between that and the Shosan ceremony, which was very similar to that because you dropped the way of that mind.
And I should say, I didn't really drop it. Like, I didn't come in and say, oh, I think I feel like crying in front of everyone tonight. It was really more like, it just happened, you know? Like a meteor that goes across the sky. In some ways, it's, I was sitting there crying, thinking, oh, you know, I don't know if it's a good thing for priests to cry in front of the Sangha. Aren't we supposed to be like, you know, a little more regal in our countenance in front of the Sangha. And then I thought, nah, what can I do about it anyway? My Kleenex is deep in here and so on. So there wasn't an I there. Michael.
Inside there's a koan practice. When you study a koan or many koans, when you were talking about the koan, just let it happen. Do you see any analogy between that and koan study? Whether you're looking for the answer, or you just let the answer happen?
Mm. That's a nice way to put that. Yeah, I think it's, yes, I would say that there is a connection, because don't a lot of koans, as you go off to think about that koan for 5 or 6 years or 1 month or 2 weeks or however long, that very often we're led to this place of who is the I or who is the me that is thinking this thought. And in the same way, when you're going out and you see a meteor, it is, did I see that meteor? Or was I looking for that meteor? Did I, the me, the Dana, have some impact on this? I mean, we live in a culture where we like to emphasize that I did this and I did that and then I did this and because of me, these things are happening. And it's very hard for us, me, to go to that place of, no, this is something that that happens collectively, socially, so that the I of it can dissolve. That would be the place where we don't have to be kind of champing at the bit or restraining ourselves from expressing the habitual frustration or anger. That's a place that with great ease we just are there. Does that answer? That was a yes. I could have just kept it really simple. Yes.
True or false next time.
True. True. Thank you. I think I understand that very well because I have a job, I find myself, I lapse into this, well, I have work and then I have Zen practice. And sometimes it's hard to, in my mind really, to make them go together. And I know I could always say, well, I do Zen practice at work, which is true. But it's not the same as being on the cushion here. It's really not. And that's a hard thing for me to say, because I think as our lives get busy, it's pretty easy to be kind of very focused and very deliberate about these places where we work, we have family, our friends, and whatever else is doesn't cross-cut or intersect with the Zen Center. Thank you. Thank you very much. Beings are endless.
possible.